you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey guys, how's it going? How's everyone doing out there? I hope you guys are good. I'm super excited about the murder this week. It is going to be kind of crazy. Matt, are you as excited as I am about it?
I'm very excited.
This is going to be good. Megan, are you excited? Because I know you're a music fan. I'm sure everyone can kind of guess who we're going to talk about. But Megan, come on. You're a fan of the Beatles.
I am so excited. I love the Beatles since I was a little kid.
Literally, Matt had emailed us with this script. And how many exclamation points did I send? I think it was just an email of exclamation points. And I was like, I can't wait. This is going to be so good. Well, the thing is that I'm kind of thirsty. And so before we get into, you know, everything that I want to talk about, because if for those of you who don't know John Lennon or the Beatles, fuck off. You shouldn't be listening to this podcast because this is just very, very sad for you. But I kind of want to know what we're drinking. Matt, did you just take a drink before I did?
I'm the host of the show. A little sip.
A little sip.
Taste test.
Literally, this is our 105th episode. We always cheers, bitch, before
Darren,
we take it.
I'm making sure that it wasn't poisoned, okay?
Well, we should also note that Gina, the staff boozer, is here because Matt's terrible at his job and sucks. And she actually needed to make something. And I turned over as Matt is sort of, you know, getting the script ready. And I see Gina in the corner. And I see her sniffing like a pint of milk. And I'm scared for my life. Gina, please make me feel better about this.
Well, maybe, before I forget, start with like a base coat of snacks.
Okay, so you think I should have some? What kind of snacks did you provide for me today?
Well, not that I regret my choices.
Ring Pop gummies. Get out of town. These are good.
I'm mining some old connections from when I used to be a food editor and got some new Ring Pop gummies sent over. Blue Diamond almonds, and they're gourmet. So we've got pink Himalayan salt.
Yum.
And garlic urban olive oil.
And what's our drink called today that we're milky strawberry fields?
Yeah, basically.
Oh.
It was John Lennon's favorite drink, supposedly. He got kicked out of a club in the 70s heckling the Smothers Brothers after he had so many of these, impressive because they're like heavy cream based.
This straight looks like a glass of milk.
I'm drinking eggnog. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's a Brandy Alexander, so it's equal parts cognac, heavy cream, and creme de cacao. So super healthy.
It's creme de cacao. That's just how I say it, Gina. Sorry. That's
and imagine how many you'd have to drink before you got ejected from a club.
I don't know. It depends on how heavy the heavy cream is. I mean, maybe only one or two. But if Matt starts heckling me, can I throw him out of this podcast, please? He seems okay with it. All right. Can we cheers, bitch, so I can actually start this thing? Is this going to give me a milk mustache?
Are you going to cheers, bitch, with us, Matt?
Matt, cheers, bitch. Come on now.
Cheers, bitch.
Cheers, bitch. Okay, hold on. I'm going to take a sip. So this could be dead air for a moment, Megan. I want you to actually, you talk while I take a sip.
Okay, so Darren is taking a sip. She has a little bit of milk mustache now.
Ooh, it's nice. Okay, I will say the drink has to be way better cold than it is warm. Like, it has to be chilled. It tastes like chocolate milk to me. Like, I don't even taste any alcohol in it.
Yeah, barely.
I'm surprised that this was John Lennon's favorite drink, I have to be honest.
I feel like
maybe he had a weak stomach and like an ulcer, so when he was like drinking it, like coated his stomach.
His name is John, I guess.
I've never heard of that name before.
His name is John.
We should have had someone like that on our show. That would have made this podcast, I think, a little bit more wholesome.
Somebody who drank, like, dairy someone milk who likes drinks sweet all the time. Drinks sweet.
Yeah, and that's named lame. John. It doesn't happen, though. That's not how it worked out.
Thank God.
Thank you, Gina, the staff boozer. This was awesome. This was really, thank really you, delicious.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
All right, guys, we might as well get into this murder because no one else will, because I'm the only one who does work around here. So here we go. Who was John Lennon and who were the Beatles? If you don't fucking know this, again, turn the podcast off.
Also, I'm just going to interject that this is a little different, this episode, from what we normally do on the show. So it's about the 60s, the Beatles, it gets into Charles Manson, it kind of goes all over the place.
I feel like it covers an entire like zeitgeist of a time, exactly. Really, than anything else, yep. Right? Okay. I'm using big words for Matt because Matt's special. Well, as you guys know, this is the beginning of December, and the reason that we're actually covering John Lennon is because he died on December 8th, which is a Saturday this week. I know we're releasing this on Sunday, but it felt super timely to talk about it literally as it was going down, so this is why we're doing it, and this is the reason. Okay, so John Lennon was born on October 9th, 1940 in Liverpool, which was a tough working-class port city. Fun fact, my girlfriend was born on October 10th and literally is obsessed with John Lennon, so this feels very appropriate. His parents separated when he was 4 years old, and his dad was mostly out of the picture. Little John went to live with his Aunt Mimi, who taught him the banjo and piano and bought him his first guitar. John's mom remarried, but visited often. Lennon was inspired by Elvis Presley at the time he met Paul McCartney in 1957. He was only 16 years old when he met Paul. The following year, McCartney introduced John to the George Harrison. Aunt Mimi was struck by a car, unfortunately, and died when John was 17, which was one of the most traumatic events of his life, which I can only imagine, like, anyone close to you dying in a car accident. But listen, he doesn't really have a close family life. Then the one person who kind of, like, picks him up from all of this dies suddenly in, like, a very tragic way.
I can't even imagine, especially when you're that young.
Right. It's going to, like, fuck you up forever, and it's going to make... I mean, every musician is always, like, moody and into their emotions, and so maybe this was sort of, like, the creative force behind all of his dark work.
Could be.
John had artistic talent, but he didn't get good grades, and a schoolmaster thought he should go to art school, which feels like such an insult. Like, oh, you don't get good grades. Like, Matt, did you go to art school?
I did not.
Did you have good grades in school?
I did. At various times, they were really good, and so right. In high school they were mediocre at times.
What's mediocre? Like
B's. Like B's.
Okay, that's better than mediocre.
Maybe a couple C's, maybe a couple A's, you know?
And you couldn't even get into art school?
Yeah, he couldn't.
I didn't try to get into art.
Went to clown college. So he had an artistic talent, but he didn't have good grades. John Lennon, Paul McCartney, and George Harrison, I hope everyone out there knows all three of them, started playing music together in the late 50s in Liverpool. The world fell in love with a squeaky clean image of four smiling lads with matching suits, but the Beatles were actually tough working class kids. In the 1968 rock book, A Wop A Loo Bop A Lop Bam Boom, Pop from the Beginning, writer Nick Cohn, can you guys believe I got that fucking right? Are you impressed?
Is so impressive.
Are you impressed?
That is so impressive.
The only reason I got it right and bringing this back full circle is because that was a song from Grease, which you guys know is my favorite movie of all time because it has Olivia Newton-John in it. There's so much to unpack here, Matt. Just, like, stop talking. Megan, you're taking over. So writer Nick Cohn wrote that the Beatles, quote, all came from working class or lower middle class backgrounds in Liverpool. And let me just say, like, this is when they're starting to play at, like, the Cavern Club in England and London, like, starting to make their name. Don't you isn't part of you, like, when you go to see a young band now, like, people who are not known, and they all dress like they're just so fucking haggard, and they wear, like, holes in their t-shirts, which I guess is cool. I would kind of want to see, like, four young boys in suits again. Like, the only person I feel like that does that is Bruno Mars.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like, he goes with, like, this old-fashioned, like, look on it, but no one ever wears suits anymore to rock concerts.
But that's charming, and I think that's why he's so popular.
I think it's, I think it's, like, wildly professional.
Absolutely.
When I went to a show with my grandfather once, he was like, I don't understand why people aren't... I was like, Grandpa, like, A, you're 90 years old, and no one... It's not like you're going to see, like, the opera. Like, you're going to see a rock and roll band. Like, they're not wearing suits, but I really feel like they should.
And the Beatles... back then didn't wear suits. They wore like
they had matching, like, outfits.
They had like leather jackets and stuff like that. They were cool. They weren't wearing suits, yeah.
Well, they were actually Teddy Boys, which is actually the British equivalent of America's greasers subculture in the 1950s. Like, just like Matt said, kind of like white t-shirt, leather jacket, greasy kind of hair, slicked back.
Teddy Boys is adorable.
Or it's like super sexual.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like Teddy Boy. I don't know. It's a lot to unpack.
They all had those little bowl cuts though.
So yeah, they did. Which cute. Is like, yeah, like a little cute. Teddy Boys were considered to be youthful rebels who dress sharp and like to listen to rock and roll. Lemmy Kilmister of the heavy metal band Motorhead described the future Fab Four as hard men. Gross. And he recalled in his autobiography seeing Lennon jump off stage at an early performance and fighting an unruly audience member who'd been heckling him. And the book says, quote, the kid went down in a mass of blood, snot, and teeth. Then John got back on the stage. Blood, Snot, and Teeth should be the name of my new band.
Yeah, it could be a Beatles cover band.
Blood, Snot, and Teeth.
Blood, Snot, and Teeth.
What's amazing is that you get into a fight and then you just get back on stage and start playing. I mean, that, you know.
That's rock and roll life to me, though. That's like Jim Morrison. Think,
like, it would probably rattle a lot of people, though. You need like a second to cool down. Not
I feel
just
like I could do it.
Get back on and play. Really?
Should I beat the shit out of you now and then just tap back on the mic?
Yeah, let's see if you can do it.
Yeah, I probably could. I wouldn't want to embarrass you, though. Despite his later peace and love image, Lennon had a reputation for violence throughout much of his life, especially if he'd been drinking, which is why we're drinking these drinks. But by most accounts, he actually did mellow out over time. On Paul McCartney's 21st birthday, Lennon got into a fight with the MC of the legendary Cavern Club, which I had mentioned earlier, named Bob Wooler, who had been one of the band's biggest early champions. Wooler had given the Beatles their first residency at the Cavern Club, but John beat him up badly. And according to the Mirror, that's not a good business plan. And according to the Mirror, quote, John was drunk at the time and left him hospitalized with broken ribs, which is kind of weird. And I know that, you know, listen, like, if you're drunk, you kind of can get this different sort of adrenaline and have a different sort of energy. But it's not like John was like this big, muscly man. I mean, he was kind of like thin and, you know, like an emotional musician type. He didn't seem to be the type of guy to just like beat the living shit out of someone. Physically, doesn't that seem a little weird?
I mean, he was pretty rough, I guess.
I guess.
He was this young, like, scrappy, working class guy.
Yeah. He
also,
was probably tough.
How tall is he? I have a feeling he might be taller than we think.
Megan's on her laptop right now looking that up. If I'm going to guess, I'm going to say John Lennon was 6 feet tall. 5'11 to 6 feet tall.
Yeah, that's pretty big, especially for back then.
I could be completely wrong.
If I had to, I haven't looked at this.
Okay, yeah.
I would say 5'8".
Yeah, he could be, like, around my height.
5'10".
Okay, all right, split
right
the difference.
Yeah.
5'10", but still, like,
not huge,
but not short either, not tiny. Not tiny.
Not at all.
Ringo Starr.
Especially in the 50s, I feel like people are taller now.
Ringo Starr's, like, my height. Like, he's, like, 5'7".
He was only 5'6", yeah.
Oh, I'm taller than him. Sorry, Ringo. Ringo! In a 1971 interview with Penthouse, Lennon said, quote, I nearly killed him because he insinuated that me and Brian had an affair in Spain. I was out of me mind. I'm just saying it like I think that John Lennon would say it. I was out of me mind. Brian Epstein was the Beatles. Oh, seriously, I think it's... Is it Epstein or Epstein? I actually think it's Epstein.
I have no idea.
I think it's Brian Epstein. Brian Epstein was the Beatles' manager who was actually gay. And there's a quote in reporter Larry Kane's book titled, quote, Lennon revealed from someone who used to work for Epstein, who said, quote, Brian was close to all of us. He never came on to any of us. He was a very private gay person. I mean, especially back in the 70s, I'm sure he was. Homosexuality was illegal. The terror of being found out was one of his main horrors, and revelation of it would have destroyed everything. It was, after all, a jailing offense.
Yeah, this is this is before the 70s, because we're still...
Definitely.
We're like, what? Maybe this is early... The fight was early 60s?
I mean, what happened to Brian was super upsetting and super sad, and it all had to do with his homosexuality, and I'm sure we'll get to that, but, you know, imagine how hard it would be. But listen, this guy is at the peak of his career, literally representing and managing, like, the greatest band of all time, and... You know, the inner terror and nightmare that he must have felt as a gay person not being able to be out was just like a different sort of job that he probably felt like he had to get through. It must have been horrible. Well, in August of 1960, the Beatles, which now included drummer Pete Best, this is way before Ringo, and bassist Stuart Sutcliffe, did a three-month residency in the Reeperbahn, which is in Hamburg, Germany's notorious red light district. It's known for its brothels, live sex shows, and nightclubs. This is very common in, like, Amsterdam. You always hear about, like, Amsterdam's red light district, which still exists. Reeperbahn is actually a music festival that still goes around to this day in Germany. At clubs like the Kaiser Keller and later on at the Star Club, the Beatles were expected to play 6 or 7 hours a night.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I read that.
I can't even imagine.
They would play sometimes from even more than that. They would play sometimes from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m.
Like, how would you even have, like, even after recording this podcast for 2 hours, sometimes I'm like, I can't talk for a little while.
It's
like,
incredible.
It's just been too much. I don't know how you haven't have the stamina to do that.
I honestly think that's probably a huge part of why they became so good. You know, if you're...
Tons of practice,
yeah,
like,
tons of practice. And you know, you like, start to gel with your bandmates when you're playing that many hours.
Yeah, but then what's the reason why we haven't gelled? And why you're not...
Some
you don't
would
get
say
any
we
better.
Have.
I mean, listen, it's 105 episodes, Matt, and I still hate you. I don't... Nothing's changed. With the exception of Pete Best, they began using amphetamines to power themselves through these marathon performances.
It's because you don't use amphetamines.
Well, I'm hoping in this drink I'm feeling a little woozy myself right now. According
it's the
to
the milk.
It is the ew. It's the milk. Hashtag it's the milk. According to the Village Voice, quote, George Harrison and Sutcliffe were regular users of Prellies.
That's right, Prellies.
Prellies? But John Lennon was the heaviest in the group. What are Prellies?
It's an amphetamine. It basically just...
Like a Quaalude? Is that what it is? Is a Quaalude considered an amphetamine?
I think is an amphetamine. But is a Quaalude is more of a downer?
I thought so. Like, yeah, a Quaalude is like you want to go to bed. It's more like a...
It's not a Quaalude then.
Yeah, no, because amphetamine like is going to keep you up, right? This is just goes to show how losers we all are when we know nothing about drugs on this podcast. In November 1960, after pissing off the German booking agent who brought them over for appearing at competing clubs, George Harrison was deported for being underage, according to his book, Anthology.
Yeah, an Anthology we quote from time to time. I guess it's not his book, it's... The Beatles giving their story, like they all contributed to Anthology.
Right.
So we're going to see Anthology throughout.
Speaking of Anthology, if you guys have not watched the Beatles Anthology, it is amazing and incredible. Soon after, McCartney and Best spent the night in jail after setting an unused condom on fire to illuminate the dank windowless room where they were staying. The damage was minimal, but they were actually deported the next day due to arson, according to USA Today. In April of 1962, Sutcliffe died in Hamburg from a cerebral hemorrhage, which according to Beatles lore was the result of a skull fracture suffered during a post-show brawl in 1961. Like, who knew that the Beatles started off in like this rough and tumble life? Like, my God.
I want to know how long a lit on fire condom will keep your room warm and light.
I want to know what it smells like.
Yeah, condoms, I kind of don't.
I want to know why you'd light a condom on fire. Probably because you weren't using it because you weren't a Beatles yet. So no one wanted to have sex with you in the same way.
Right. Your house was dark and
you needed
damn.
A little light. Yeah, a little condom.
Sutcliffe, I just want to add, was supposedly the coolest of the Beatles.
Oh, he has an alliterative name.
Extremely cool. He was sort of like, had this punk rock aesthetic. He would wear sunglasses at night, and he dressed like super cool.
Oh, so he's me. So he's, Stuart Sutcliffe is me of the Beatles. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, yeah. And I'm Best.
You're Pete Best. Yes, yes, yes. Not that you are the best, but that you're Pete Best.
I'm Best.
John, do you know what time of year it is?
Well, Halloween is over and the holidays are right around the corner. That makes it engagement season.
Get ready to have your Insta feed flooded with engagement ring selfies and your weekends flooded with hunting for the perfect wedding gift.
Come on, Darren. It's almost 2019. We've got Zola now. Wedding gift guessing games are a thing of the past. Zola takes the stress out of wedding planning with free wedding websites, your dream wedding registry, affordable save the dates and invitations, and easy to use planning tools. It's never been more convenient to manage everything online and in one place. It saves a ton of time for couples.
You and your pookie get to start with a free wedding website that's super easy and just takes a few minutes to set up. There are tons of website designs to choose from. You can add photos, stories about who you met, travel, and accommodation info for your guests. Even an FAQ section to answer awkward questions like whether your cousin Trent can bring a plus one.
Then you and your sugar plum can build your dream registry. Zola makes registering for newly wed life super easy. They've got the widest selection of gifts, over 500 top brands at all different price points. You can also create funds for your honeymoon, future home, new puppy, whatever you want. There's something for everyone to give.
Ooh, they also have the best completion discount. 20% off remaining gifts on your registry starting right after your big day.
To start your free wedding website and also get $50 off your registry on Zola, go to zola.com/martinis.
That's zola.com/martinis.
Sutcliffe has always been a specter haunting the early days of the Beatles' history, but at the time of his death, he had been out of the band for nearly a year. You know, the thing about bands is that, like, people usually know, like, the iconic members once they're established, but it takes so long and so many iterations of a band to sort of be perfect. Like, so many bands from the 60s were, like, once Blind Faith, they're turned into Eric Clapton, which became Cream, and, like, there's so many different iterations of, like, drummers dropping out and singers dropping out and new players being formed. Like, groups change all the time.
Groups change a lot, and
sometimes people can't cut it.
Sometimes people can't cut it, right. Or sometimes they want to move on, and they move on.
And leave without a moment's notice.
Guys, let's move on.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I was getting verklempt.
Sometimes they have hissy fits.
Matt, we have to move on. Okay. This is gonna be an emotional episode for me. In August of 1962, John married Cynthia Lennon. The two had been dating since 1959 when John had asked her out after they were in a college class together. Man, like, what if you could say that John Lennon asked you out? That's got to be the, even as a lesbian, that's got to be the coolest thing ever. Despite whoever he is, like, that's dope. When John first asked her out, she said no because she was engaged. Even though the engagement had been called off, he replied, "I didn't ask you to marry me, did I?" Whoa. This is my hero right
here. Fucking good for him.
Yeah, I know. He was like, bitch, all I want to do is go out with you. I don't want to marry you.
Then he did sort of taunt her, and she overheard him telling his friends that she was a nun.
That's...
I mean, she proved him wrong, I guess.
Now when Matt asks me to hang out for go for drinks or wants to sleep over in my basketball shorts, I'm just going to tell him I converted to being a nun. Cynthia would later comment in her memoir, A Twist of Lennon. That's a great name. Twist of Lennon, that John was jealous and prone to unreasonable rages. I was really quite terrified of him for 75% of the time. That's pretty crazy. In a 1980 interview with Playboy, shortly before he would die, Lennon said, "I used to be cruel to my woman and physically any woman. I was a hitter. I couldn't express myself and I hit. I fought men and I hit women." Which, listen, is never a good thing. Like, no one wants to condone it. I just think that it says something that he's at least willing to admit it. Like, at least that says something to me, like, doesn't make it right, but he's aware of his, I don't know, displacement of emotional energy. Like, I don't know what that is, right?
I agree. And he also, and again, no condoning, of course, as you said, but he also, a lot of people around him said that he was truly, felt a lot of remorse, that it seemed like really genuine. He couldn't control himself.
Right.
And then he would seek their love and be very, very remorseful, etc.
Well, let's hope that, I mean, that sort of changed his ways. But in the interview, he actually also said, quote, "That is why I'm always on about peace. You see, it's the most violent people who go for love and peace," end quote. Do you think that's true? Is it the most violent people? I mean, listen, I think that's like sort of a hypocritical thing. I don't think now, but I mean, I guess in a way, it's nice that he sort of reversed course and focused so much on promoting peace and prosperity to the world,
right? I mean, not that it makes up for it, but it's nice that he sort of changed his ways.
Yeah.
He wasn't promoting violence.
That maybe was his journey. For a lot of people who are violent, that's not their journey. But for some reason, he backed that up a little bit.
Yeah.
I could see it as being just a good way for him to make amends for the things he'd done in the past.
Guilt kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah. And I could see that being a way that maybe violent people who legitimately feel remorseful go.
Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe he knew people like that and was empathizing.
I guess. I mean, it is. I never even thought about it, but like he was such a big force in the peace movement. I never even thought about the juxtaposition of him actually being violent. Well, John and Cynthia's son, Julian, would later say, which was actually why Paul McCartney wrote Hey Jude. Mm-hmm. It's actually for Julian. Quote, Mom was more about love than Dad. He sang about her. He spoke about it, but he never really gave it, at least not to me as his son, according to the Mirror. In the fall of 1962, the Beatles would release their debut single, Love Me Do, their first hit in Britain. And if you listen to that song, which I listen to any Beatles song now, like to this day, I can listen to albums over and over and over again, and it still tracks and it still hits and it still holds up. It's literally the simplest song ever. There's like four lines in it. And it's a hit, like a complete smash. And it's just great. It's so wholesome.
A wonderful song. Yeah.
It's a wonderful song.
It's poppy and everybody can sort of like get with the lyrics of it.
100%. And like the thing about any band, I mean, you can sort of see like the evolution of like, you know, them experimenting. But the Beatles specifically, like you really see the times and when they started to do drugs and when they came out with Sgt. Pepper, you know, compared to when they came out with like Meet the Beatles and stuff like that. Like it's just really cool to track their whole history. In the fall of by early 1964, they had conquered America. Superstardom beckoned and with it, new temptations and dangers. In April of 1964, John Lennon's dad showed up at the offices of the Beatles management company. Epstein sent for John, whose first words were, "What do you want?" They hadn't seen each other in 17 years, and clearly the visit didn't go well. Around this time, Lennon was still prone to bouts of violence. Here's another excerpt of Larry Kane's book. Quote, as we walked down the steps of the Beatles plane at the airport in Minneapolis on August 21st, 1965, a print reporter came up to John to ask him a question, her face only inches away from his. I didn't hear her remark, but I will never forget the response. John slapped her in the face and moved quickly toward the car. Approaching the limo, I asked him, quote, what was that all about? End quote. Before I could blink, he answered, none of your fucking business. End quote. I mean, I don't really know what to say to that. Like, do we think that she insulted him? She must have. He wouldn't just slap a reporter.
She asked if he was faithful to his wife.
Well.
And the answer was no. But also back then, and again, come on, that's atrocious behavior.
Atrocious.
Keep slapping a woman in the face. That's just, why didn't he just, like, keep walking and ignore her? But back then, and no excuses, back then, this is before reporters really pried into private lives like they do now. You know, but you didn't have, like, TMZ reporters following people around. Did you cheat with so-and-so or whatever? That didn't exist. There was more privacy back then, you know, for celebrities.
Of course.
So that reporter, you know, maybe she was a little ahead of her time or whatever, but that was considered inappropriate.
I mean, that is inappropriate, I think, too, because it's also like, why the fuck do you give a shit if I'm faithful to my wife? And it has nothing to do with my craft. But, like, at the same time, don't slap her. Like,
I mean, we know that he's not, like, above slapping a woman who is his wife. And also, not that I condone it, but I'm legitimately surprised that more reporters don't get slapped in the face, like, now.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised. I mean, I think there's more consequences now, like, you know, like more lifetime reporting. But yeah, I mean, some of the times that people ask, I'm like, it's really none of our business what they do behind closed doors. Like, stay out of my business and I'll stay out of yours. I mean, some places it's warranted. But well, Kane also wrote that John had a pattern of trying to make amends and be loved after lashing out. His remorse was very sincere, which also begs the question, why isn't he learning from it? Like, I hate feeling remorse and guilt. Obviously, I feel it when I do something bad, but usually that just reminds me to, like, not do it again.
It's because they didn't have anger management courses.
That's true.
Yeah, if he has legitimate
issues,
anger issues, that takes a long time sometimes to
figure it out.
Yeah, you know what? That's a really good point, Megan. Take a drink. He became famous so quickly, right? They all did. I mean, it's incredible that they met.
Yeah. Yeah.
He met McCartney at 16, and then they turned into the world's biggest band. And I think, you know, he obviously didn't have the easiest childhood in the world. He has some issues.
It's like being in the public spotlight with all those demons still surrounding you.
Yeah, and then having intense pressure and not having enough space to kind of figure things out for yourself, which is hard enough to do for anybody.
Right.
Let alone you're in the spotlight, there's all this pressure, you're going, you're performing, you know, 7 hours a night or whatever.
That is the most insane. I mean, I could never do anything for 7 hours.
And if he's
sleep.
Abusing these amphetamines.
Well, that's true, because it could highlight.
Oh, yeah.
Forget it.
Yeah, right. You can't. And drinking, whatever the hell we're drinking. I don't even remember what it's called. What's the drink called today?
I don't know.
See, milk. I'm already drunk. Grab milk. Gross. By the mid-60s, the Beatles were the biggest pop group in the world and moved from their provincial northern hometown to London, the capital of Britain's entertainment industry. In London was also their record label, EMI, and its famed Abbey Road Studios, and I've been there, where all the Beatles' albums were recorded.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
In quote swing in London, the Fab Four got the attention of the infamous East End gangsters known as the Krays with the K, twin brothers Ronnie and Reggie, who ran protection rackets and orchestrated robberies. According to the Mirror, Ronnie and Reggie got life in prison in 1968 for two murders. And according to the book, The Krays, A Violent Business, the twins once approached Beatles manager Brian Epstein about taking over management of the group. When Epstein wasn't going for it, Ronnie rammed a nail through a man's cheek who was in the room to show that the twins meant business.
These people were insane.
This is insane!
I looked them up, and first of all, they look so mean. They look huge, and they just look so,
Ronnie and Reggie.
So mean. Yeah, and they basically were England's version of the American mafia. They sort of ran everything.
Seems it.
Police, they were sort of untouchable for a long, long time, and they finally went down. But, we're looking at a picture.
They do look super
mean.
They
look like so old-timey gangsters with like the big wide ties and the suspenders and like broad shoulders. Oh my God, they do look a little scary. Ooh.
So, and there's also an interesting anecdote, which is they got the idea of managing bands from someone in the American mafia. They kind of talked, you know, traded best practices or whatever. And that's what the mafia was doing in America. They managed, you know, musical acts, and the American that they were talking to said, you guys should get into the music business and television, you know, industry, basically. So they decided, oh, okay, we're going to manage the Beatles.
Well, the Beatles continued experimenting with drugs as the 60s wore on. Yeah, because it's the fucking 60s. Bob Dylan allegedly smoked the band out for the first time on a 1964 tour, and John Lennon told Penthouse, quote, he turned us on to pot. Which, another really, I mean, outside of just being Bob Dylan, like, another really cool, fun fact that, like, Bob Dylan got the Beatles on the pot. Like, dope. Literally and figuratively, dope. In that same interview, he referred to 1965's Rubber Soul as the pot album. The Beatles' 1960 album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, is considered to be the first masterpiece of the psychedelic era, and the group had already been indulging in hallucinogens for a couple of years. I think that Sgt. Pepper, I think the Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys was the response to Sgt. Pepper, or the other way around?
I believe it's the other way around.
The other way around.
Yes.
So Sgt. Pepper was a result of Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys, which
is
arguably one of the greatest albums of all time.
Yeah, I love Pet Sounds. The Beatles were working on Sgt. Pepper's, but Pet Sounds came out first.
Right.
And
then they tweaked it to even more heavy drug.
Yeah.
God only knows is like my favorite song.
Listened to Pet Sounds and said, they beat us.
Yeah. There was such strong competition back then. Lennon, George Harrison, and their wives were first given acid in the spring of 1965 at a dinner party thrown by their dentist, who put LSD-laced sugar cubes in their coffee because he wanted to be the first to turn them onto the drug, according to Vice.
And history was changed.
Surprise! History was changed, but, like, I love that, like,
people want to be the first people to introduce someone to a drug. Like, oh, I'm going to drug you because I want to be the first to introduce you to heroin. Like, what?
Darren, there is LSD in your milk.
Thank God. Now this will be interesting getting to work with you. Actually, I need another drink. Is it possible?
I don't know how to make it.
Well, maybe
you want just brandy?
Give me a little, you know what? Give me just a little brandy. Let's try this. I want to be like an old school man. When the dentist told them that by the way, you're Matt the bartender, and you know how he's just like, I don't know how to make the drink.
I mean, if it were me, I would just pour the brandy into the
milk. Or I'd look up a fucking recipe and then make it because all the ingredients are there, but that's fine. He's getting me brandy. Thank you, Matt. When the dentist told them what he had done, according to Rolling Stone, John said, how dare you fucking do this to us? According to the book, 1965, the most revolutionary year in music, Cynthia Lennon, John's first wife, said, quote, it was as if we suddenly found ourselves in the middle of a horror film. The room seemed to get bigger and bigger. Our host seemed to change into a demon. After the experience, George Harrison later told Rolling Stone, quote, I had such an overwhelming feeling of well-being that there was a God and I could see him in every blade of grass. It was like gaining hundreds of years of experience in 12 hours. Wow. Have you ever done LSD?
I have not.
Matt?
No comment.
Sure. Read into that what you will, folks. Rolling Stone wrote that, quote, the unwitting initiation into LSD would find its fulfillment the following year in Revolver. Again, I just love how, like, every album maps their own experience, which I guess seems to make sense, but, like, you don't get that sense with, like, Arcade Fire, Bruno Mars. Like, you don't get that sense of, like, transformation of what's going down. Like, it's such a sign of the times.
Hey, Dedicators, are you dying for more true crime? How about a multi-million dollar scam? Bernie Madoff was the criminal mastermind behind one of the greatest lies ever told. It was called the scam of the century. He ruined the lives of tens of thousands of victims in as many as 136 countries and committed a $65 billion fraud for which he received the maximum sentence, 150 years in prison. On the anniversary of the scandal, December 10th, join American Greed executive producer Chuck Schaefer and CNBC special correspondent Scott Cohn as they go behind bars in a three-part special series to uncover the Madoff of today, his victims, and the financial ripple effect left in the wake of this con. Scott Cohn is one of the few journalists to ever meet with Madoff in prison, a two-hour sit-down in 2013, and he'd stayed in touch over the past decade. I'm sure the stories he has to tell are completely fascinating and a must-listen for anyone who is obsessed with true crime stories as I am. To listen, subscribe to the American Greed podcast today on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
John Lennon and George Harrison dropped acid again that summer at a party in-house they had rented in Los Angeles with the drummer Ringo. By the way, I love how he's pissed that, like, okay, granted the dentist, like, kind of poisoned them by putting LSD and, like, tricking them, but, like, then he just goes back to do it again. So, like, he kind of realizes its value. Some others attended included actor Peter Fonda, according to Rolling Stone. Matt, I think you have something to add on this.
I do. Also, some members of the Byrds were there, and they wanted
Byrds with a Y.
They wanted to get to know each other, and this was, like, their first meeting, I guess. And so they wanted to just see what would happen if they did acid together. So, yeah, there's just another interesting excerpt from Rolling Stone. Actor Peter Fonda, who attended the party along with the members of the Byrds, later said, I remember sitting out on the deck of the house with George, who was telling me that he thought he was dying. I told him that there was nothing to be afraid of at all, and that all he needed to do was relax. I said that I knew what it was like to be dead, because when I was 10 years old, I'd accidentally shot myself in the stomach, and my heart stopped beating three times while I was on the operating table because I had lost so much blood. Now, it's just, this conversation is extremely important. That's why we're...
But, like, wait, can we break down how you accidentally shoot yourself in the stomach?
Playing with your dad's gun. I'm going with playing with his dad's gun.
10 years old.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Like, your foot, I sort of get. Like, if it's in the holster and you... But, like, in your stomach, that must mean that you were, like, facing the gun towards you.
Yep.
I mean, if you're 10, you're just, like, looking at it, you're turning it around.
Well, Jesus dear Lord. Like, that is... I don't know. I've never accidentally shot myself in the stomach, so I guess I can't relate. Is that it of the quote?
That's it.
All right, well...
Jeez, that's what you want to hear, though, I think, when you're on an acid trip.
Well, apparently,
right, exactly.
Apparently, it freaked them out, though.
Yeah, I bet it did.
Really?
Freaked out George Harrison, and Lennon was listening and was very upset.
You just gotta relax, man. One time I shot myself in the stomach when I was 10.
And all's okay, man. All's fine. Just chill. Well, the song She Said on Revolver was written by Lennon about taking LSD at a party in L.A., and the lyrics include a conversation that Peter Fonda had with Harrison. Rolling Stone wrote, quote, "The song was a rendering of the Los Angeles encounter with Fonda and how it had lingered for Lennon. She said, I know what it's like to be dead. I know what it is to be sad. I said, even though you know what you know, I know that I'm ready to leave because you're making me feel like I've never been born." I don't even know what I just fucking read. Like, am I on LSD? Like, I have no idea.
Well,
it's kind of deep, though.
I believe Lennon told Fonda to stop and said, "You're making me feel like I've never been born." Okay, this is a total drug thing. We're having a conversation about somebody's trip. Basically.
Correct, yeah. Correct. In the book anthology, Paul McCartney said, quote, "The final track on Revolver, Tomorrow Never Knows, was definitely John's." Round about this time, people were starting to experiment with drugs, including LSD. Okay, so basically, if you want to know what it's like to be on LSD, just listen to Revolver over and over again.
Yes.
Right? Like, just do that. You don't even need to be on LSD. Another song, quote, "Dr. Robert," paid a sly tribute to a Manhattan physician who was rumored to dole out pills to New York celebrity populace, according to Rolling Stone. Now, that I knew.
Yes.
Dr. Robert, yeah. I knew that. After Cynthia took a vacation, she returned home to find John and Yoko Ono sitting cross-legged and facing each other.
This is brutal.
Yoko was wearing Cynthia's bathrobe. God, this has to be, like, gut-wrenching.
According to the Irish Times.
The guest room seemingly hadn't been slept in, according to The Independent. John had met Yoko at her art exhibit in London in 1966, and he loved a tiny painting on the ceiling that was visible at the top of a ladder through a magnifying glass. The painting was of a word, yes.
That is...
Can we talk about that? Like, why is that art?
You know,
Let's talk about that.
I think it's cute, though. I think it's cute, because it's... I love how Lennon... So, well... Because it's about an experiment, right? Like, you have to... Art is usually a very passive experience, so I'm assuming you have to climb up the ladder and then look at the ceiling,
right.
Look through a magnifying glass, and the word yes is there. So it becomes, like, a participatory thing, right? Like, you're inviting someone into the artistic experience, and then... Whatever. Okay, this is not an art
class. I feel
class.
Like going all that work
Continue.
Just to see a fucking thing saying yes, I'd be like...
Well, hey, man, it's the whole reason that they got together.
Well, that's true. In 1968, Lennon had moved on to heroin, which he spoke about in a 1971 interview with Rolling Stone magazine, saying, it was just not too much fun, according to him. Which, yeah, because I feel like heroin, like, isn't supposed to be a fun drug. It's supposed to be, like, you want to not experience anything. Type of thing, like you just want to sit there and like get away from your reality.
I hear it's good the first time.
Maybe let's try
it's really good for the first 10 times, honestly, and then it just becomes a nightmare.
Oh really? So
you know, I'm completely kidding.
I was gonna be like, uh-huh.
Megan was looking at me like,
we're like, how do we know this?
I believe
I've never ever done heroin.
Sure. John and Yoko married in 1969. The 1969 single Cold Turkey by the Plastic Ono Band chronicled Lennon and wife Yoko Ono's attempts to kick heroin, which they did that same year. I will say, it does seem like they were such a good couple in terms of them supporting each other. Like, it was all about them. Like, she would go wherever he went and vice versa. Like, they were just enmeshed within each other. While Paul McCartney was initially mocked by his Beatles bandmates for not following them into the acid zone, he said to Uncut Magazine, quote, "I did cocaine for about a year around the same time of Sgt. Pepper," end quote. McCartney later began to indulge in weed and, along with first wife Linda, racked up multiple busts for marijuana possession, including a 9-day stint in jail after getting caught with almost half a pound of weed in Japan in 1980, according to the music website NME.
But he didn't have to kick heroin.
Right.
So.
I mean, now knowing what we sort of know, it's like, oh, this, like, Paul McCartney's like a little innocuous. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, oh, he's sweet.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer.
So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
As beatific figureheads of the 60s counterculture, the Beatles were often looked to for guidance in a time of widespread social turmoil. One of those who found great meaning in their music was petty criminal turned murderous cult leader, my favorite, your favorite, Charles Manson. Manson, who had pop music aspirations of his own, had surrounded himself with a harem of young women and hangers-on after his 1967 release from prison, taking full advantage of the free love and rampant drug use of the hippie era.
He also had a weird connection with the Beach Boys.
He did. He lived with Dennis.
Yes.
Yeah, he lived with Dennis.
Like, didn't they write a song together?
Yeah, and like Dennis, like he was in and out of the house. Like that's, like they had a very, very close friendship.
Have you guys listened to Charles Manson's album?
No.
No.
Should I?
Ridiculous.
Like, in good way?
In, like, a ridiculous way.
Can I find it on Spotify?
I think probably. You can. Yeah, it's readily, like, available for consumption. It's easy to find.
I have. It's so weird that I haven't listened to it. I have to ask my girlfriend if she has. I'm sure she has. By 1968, he and his followers, known as The Family, were living communally in Southern California, and Manson became obsessed with the Beatles' eponymous ninth album, commonly known as The White Album, which had just been released.
Which is your favorite album, Darren?
Of all time, of all the Beatles?
Yeah.
Probably Sgt. Pepper is up there. I really do like it. Although White Album, I've seen the Fab Four, which is like this amazing cover band by the Beatles. It sounds exactly like them. I've seen them perform the White Album maybe two or three times. So I do like the White Album. What about you?
Mine is Revolver and the White Album.
Let It Be has got to be up there for me as well. But I do like Sergeant. Megan, do you have a preference?
Definitely Sergeant Pepper.
Yeah. It's just fun and colorful. Manson believed the songs on the album foretold an apocalyptic race war, which would subsume the earth. He's specifically talking about Helter Skelter here, after which the Manson family would rule over the survivors. Quote, this music is bringing on the revolution, the unorganized overthrow of the establishment, end quote. Manson later told Rolling Stone magazine. Manson referred to this scenario as Helter Skelter, the name of a song off the White Album. And in order to set it in motion, he orchestrated a series of shocking murders in the summer of 1969. Well, on the night of August 8th, 1969, members of the Manson family viciously murdered actor Sharon Tate and four house guests at the Los Angeles home she rented with her husband, Roman Polanski, who was in Europe directing a movie at the time, according to the Washington Post. I will say, so my girlfriend's like obsessed with the Manson murders. I think I've mentioned this before. And she's actually reading Helter Skelter, which is a book out right now about the Manson murders. And apparently it's amazing. And so she's over at my apartment the other night and I'm like stressed from work and I'm like super tired or something. And she's like, have you ever seen the crime scene photos of like Sharon Tate? And I was like, I don't know, babe. Like, I don't know. And so she goes onto her laptop and she starts looking on my laptop. So in my search history is like Sharon Tate's like bloody body. And she starts looking it up and showing to me. And I got so disturbed that I literally looked at her and I go, I don't want to look at this anymore. Like, I can't look at this anymore. It is too fucking terrible. Like, horrendous. And that just goes to show how sick my girlfriend is.
Maybe, you know, we have a job opening at Oxygen.
Oh, honestly, like, she would love it. Sick fuck. Tate was 8.5 months pregnant when she was murdered. The word pig was written on the front door of the house in her blood, according to the Post. And then next night, Manson accompanied members of the family to L.A.'s Los Feliz neighborhood, where they murdered supermarket executive Lino LaBianca and his wife Rosemary, according to the L.A. Times. Actually, one of the Folgers kids also died, who was going to... inherit it. At the LaBianca crime scene, Manson's followers left behind graffiti again written in their victim's blood saying Helter Skelter, which was spelled wrong. So Helter is spelled H-E-L-T-E-R, but the way that the Manson family had actually spelled it was H-E-A-L-T-E-R. So Helter Skelter. And
Learn to read, Manson.
I know. Like, guys, if you're going to kill someone, like, at least be accurate.
They weren't being educated. They were in a cult.
I mean, they use one more letter with their blood. And death to pigs, according to Newsweek. Manson and nine other family members would eventually be convicted for the Tate LaBianca murders and other crimes, with most of them receiving the death penalty, which was related to commuted to life in prison. If you guys remember, Manson actually died last year in prison at the age of 83, looking fucking nuts. Like, you gotta look up the pictures of him. He's just like absolutely insane.
They're so brutal.
They're so brutal, and just like looking at him is genuinely terrifying. And listen, they say that
gone, right?
Yeah. I mean,
Remember when he got married for a second? And then
no, he did, because he had such a cult following even in prison. Yeah. Like, 21-year-olds were obsessed with him, which is so bizarre to me. And remember after we came back from CrimeCon and I met one of the people who was in the family and I got her to sign my book?
Yeah.
Okay, so I, like, talked to her, mm-hmm. and I was like, just tell me, like, what was he like? You know, because to me, I mean, granted, it's a different time and I wasn't homeless. My parents didn't kick me out or anything, you know, and so I'm not in a vulnerable position. But I was like, how can you be so blinded by someone? Like, what is it about this man that just sort of, like, you know, encapsulated you? And she was just like, you have no idea how charming he was.
Yeah,
you
of
know,
course.
Like, you have no idea.
That's like a lot of cult leaders.
You've got to
totally
be.
Like, but looking at his picture, I'm like, how the fuck would this dude
yeah,
be charming?
Yeah, but have you seen the pictures of him when he was young?
Yeah, he was cute.
He was good looking.
Yeah,
he
was
gave
cute.
Him all those drugs.
Yeah, 100%.
My dad, side fact, my dad worked at the prison where Manson was.
Yo.
For a while.
Really?
Yeah.
Did he, like, interact with
him? No. He was so in solitary confinement, which is why he went crazy.
He was crazy before, but yeah.
Yeah, of course. But he literally, that's why I was saying he's, like, kind of checked out. Like, he wasn't the same.
I just took a sip of my brandy.
Yeah, and there's a very secure part of that prison. And it's kind of like where the worst of the worst go.
Yeah,
in
right.
California, right? And my dad said there are signs that say, like, all over the place in this part of the prison, like, no second chances, no warnings. Like, if they tell you to do something and you don't do it,
like, you're fucked.
I mean, like, no second chances.
Holy shit. Hey, Matt, no second chances. Reflecting on the events years later, George Harrison would say in an anthology, quote, "It was upsetting to be associated with something so sleazy as Charles Manson." With Ringo Starr saying in an anthology, quote, "I mean, I knew Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. God, it was a rough time." And, you know, that really changed the 60s itself. I mean, I feel like that was a defining moment where, like, people stopped, you know, leaving their doors open and trusting people. I really think it really changed everything there. I mean, I can only imagine how Dennis in the Beach Boys, granted he died and he drowned not too long after that, but I could only imagine, like, his involvement with it and how he really felt about it, like, when it all came out. I think this is actually a good place to stop right now, guys, because I'm trying to give you some history of everything that went down, and I really want to go through the murder of John Lennon, but I really needed to give you a full background, so I think we're going to pause here.
Yeah.
I'm going to get some more brandy.
You know, we're going to get some more brandy. You know, the 60s, I'll just end with, there was a lot of turmoil, a lot of changes. A lot of changes happened. And
tons of changes, people
bands,
coming in and out of the band.
People, you know, they break up sometimes.
Sometimes you get into a little quarrel and there's no coming back from it. And
yeah,
that's
and
it.
Some
and that's the only
have
thing that you
fits
have.
And they walk out or
Guys, HR said.
Oh, keep it together. Matt, keep it together. Let's just end here because I'm clearly getting emotional about this whole thing. So,
you mean John Lennon?
I mean John. Oh, I mean
and
John.
And Charles Manson.
Yeah, I mean John. I definitely mean John.
John Lennon.
Yes, John Lennon. Okay, before we go, I have one hilarious listener shout out, okay? This is Stephanie Ginwright on our Martinis and Murder podcast fan. She said, "I had a dream that Matt was 20-something, blonde, Matt Bomer-looking motherfucker, and now I'm all conflicted because I'm a lesbian with a Darren crush in my waking life." Okay, I write back to this comment and I say, "I'm confused, flattered, and insulted by all of this." And John was, like, freaking out, laughing hysterically. Now, Megan, as a side observer, who isn't me, who isn't Matt, you know who Matt Bomer is, right?
I do not.
Oh, my God. Look him up right now. He's an actor. He's, like, wildly attractive. He's literally, like, a perfect-looking man. He's not blonde, though. He's brunette. Perfect-looking man. How much of Matt, because you can see his actual face right now.
What has he been in?
He was in...
Oh.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
How much of Matt looks like Matt Bomer?
Well,
5%.
Matt Bomer is a strapping...
Strapping.
Very strapping
gay man. Yes.
And our Matt is a mangy deer. So
wow, even Megan described
5%.
You as mangy.
Jesus Christ.
Mangy, Matt.
Who's this user again? I mean, user.
User?
Sorry.
You're such a dick. Who's this user?
I'm sorry.
Stephanie
I'm used to talking to people on the website, and we call them users.
Oh,
because they use the website.
Who's this fan?
Who is this, this human?
Stephanie Jin Wright.
Jen, I like your name.
No, Stephanie Jin Wright.
Jen Wright. Jen, I like that part of her name. That's all I'm saying.
Well,
Jen.
She responded
Jen
to me saying... She responded by saying the dream continued, but I don't want to talk about it. But in my response, that's what I want to know, Stephanie. You got to tell us.
She said she was a lesbian?
She's a lesbian. And she responded to my comment of being confused, flattered, and insulted with, Darren Karp, please don't be insulted. Be flattered. You're amazing. I'll be confused. My subconscious should be ashamed. So even her subconscious hates you, Matt. Like, she woke up feeling fucking guilty.
Stephanie, right?
I literally told you this 2 seconds ago. Let's just call her user. Facebook user. Like, Jesus Christ, Matt. You're so sad. Continue being a lesbian, Stephanie.
I love this story.
I bet Matt Bomer would remember her name.
Oh, Matt Bomer would definitely remember your name. And I can't believe... I'm, like, a little insulted that she's dreaming about Matt and not me. Right? I feel like I have a right to that.
I mean, she likes you in real life.
That's
so.
True. IRL. We can't help what our subconscious does.
I think her subconscious is trying to tell her something. Maybe she hasn't quite traveled on the right path in life.
Or maybe she just wishes that you look like Matt Bomer, because if she actually knew what you looked like, it would be hell on earth.
Maybe the month ends in an R and she's up for hunting season.
Oh, that might be better. Well, Stephanie Jin Wright, you're amazing. I have a lesbian crush on you. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. We're really going to get into the murder next week. Like I said, in the meantime... go listen to the White Album, or at least Sgt. Pepper, because that's really listen to the entire anthology, right?
Or Charles Manson's album.
That's probably a better suggestion, Megan. I would suggest starting with that, and let's see how it goes. I'm going to do it by the time we record next week. So thanks for listening, guys. Really appreciate it. Bye.
Bye. Bye.